Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into the fascinating stories behind the figures you think you know, uncovering the surprising facts and the deeper truths that often get lost in history books. Today, we're unearthing the incredible and, frankly, often contradictory life of Zachary Taylor, the 12th President of the United States. And here's a fact that might just make you sit up straight. This battle-hardened national hero, a man who epitomized resilience, served only 16 months in office. What's more, he was the last president born before the U.S. Constitution was even adopted. This isn't just about dates, you know, it's about a man who, at almost every turn, seemed to defy expectations right up to his, well, his mysterious end. You might know the name Zachary Taylor, but what about the incredible journey from a rough-and-tumble frontier upbringing to a military legend, and the truly surprising turn into the political maelstrom of his brief presidency, and even the enduring mystery surrounding his death? Our mission today is to take a deep dive into all these surprising facts and their implications, bringing to life a figure often overlooked, a real old rough-and-ready story, if you will.
What's truly fascinating and a critical insight here is not just that he was a political answer. I mean, a career military officer who, astonishingly, never even voted before his own election.
That's still amazing to me.
It really is. But it's what that meant for his leadership. He ascended to the highest office with a profound disconnection from the political machinery, you know. And then he faced the most divisive issue of his time, slavery, head-on. His vague political beliefs weren't just a personal quirk. They challenged the very foundations of his own party and the nation. It led to this unique, often isolated style of leadership that really defied traditional expectations. It's a testament to how an outsider can be thrust into the political maelstrom, for better or worse, and how that outsider status can shape a presidency.
Absolutely. So our purpose today is to extract the key insights from all our sources about Zachary Taylor's life, his legendary military career, his incredibly tumultuous and brief presidency, and the controversies that followed him even beyond the grave. We want to give you a shortcut to truly understanding this often overlooked figure, seeing him not just as a name, but as a complex man grappling with an equally complex nation on the brunt. Okay, let's unpack this incredible journey starting right at the beginning. We'll call this part one. From Virginia planter to military legend, the making of old Rough and Ready, Zachary Taylor was born November 24, 1784, into a prominent planter family of English ancestry in Orange County, Virginia. Now, even his exact birthplace is a bit of a historical puzzle. Some sources suggest Hare Forest Farm, others Montebello. He was the third of five surviving sons, and his father, Richard Taylor, was a lieutenant colonel in the American Revolution. What kind of lineage are we talking about here? And how did that privileged background square with his later rough and ready image?
It's quite a storied lineage, really, and it paints a picture of deep roots in early American society. It's not just about his father, though that's significant, but his mother's side as well. Taylor was a descendant of some truly foundational American figures, including Elder William Brewster, a Pilgrim leader and Mayflower immigrant, and Isaac Allerton Jr. Through that line, he was actually a second cousin to James Madison, the fourth president.
Wow, Madison.
Yeah, an intellectual giant of the early republic. And for those keeping track of historical connections, he was also a member of the famous Lee family of Virginia. That made him a third cousin once removed to Confederate General Robert E. Lee.
Small world.
Indeed. His family, seeing opportunity and the promise of land, moved westward to Louisville, Kentucky. His father did very well there, acquiring some 10,000 acres and, importantly, 26 slaves. So despite the rough and ready moniker, he came from a very established slave-owning Southern elite.
Wow. Imagine growing up in that kind of frontier environment. A prominent family, yes, but right on the edge of expansion. Witnessing such events firsthand. Our sources even recount an anecdote where Taylor himself claimed to have witnessed Native Americans abduct and scalp his classmates while they were walking down the road together.
Yeah.
That's a stark picture of a challenging, often violent childhood. It must have instilled a certain stoicism, wouldn't you say, a kind of bluntness. Do you think that environment cultivated a specific type of leader, one perhaps ill-suited for the subtle back and forth of Washington, but maybe perfectly honed for command?
Absolutely. That frontier upbringing, coupled with his family's position, was formative. It definitely cultivated a practicality, a directness, and a resilience that would define him. His formal education was, well, sporadic, really. Kentucky's system was just developing back then. His mother taught him to read and write, and he later attended a couple of schools where he was noted as a quick learner. Though, funnily enough, his early letters showed a weak grasp of spelling and grammar. Yeah, something that did improve over time, even if his handwriting remained famously difficult to read. This blend of frontier pragmatism and inherited privilege is really key to understanding the contradictions we'll see in his later life. And this isn't just a detail, it's a critical insight into the inherent contradictions that would define Taylor. He was a Southern planter, a slaveholder. His family's prosperity was deeply tied to that system. This background would lead many to assume a particular political stance, right? Yet, as we'll uncover, his pragmatic and nationalist views often put him at direct odds with the pro-slavery expansionist agenda, even within his own party.
That's fascinating.
It sets up a fascinating, almost tragic tension that he carried throughout his life. In June 1810, he married Margaret McCall Smith, affectionately known as Peggy. She came from a prominent Maryland planter family herself. They went on to have 6 children, and 2 of them would become deeply intertwined with the nation's future. One daughter, Sarah Knox Taylor, would famously marry Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis, the future Confederate president.
The very same, though she tragically died young only months after the wedding. And another son, Richard Taylor, would also become a Confederate Army general.
Wow. Those are deeply significant connections, binding his personal story right into the coming civil conflict.
So we see Taylor deeply embedded in the Southern planter system, with these complex family ties echoing through national history. But his personal story, his character, was truly forged in a different crucible. The relentless demands of a military career that spanned decades and defined him as old, rough, and ready.
Right. So the Taylor family maintained Baton Rouge, Louisiana, as their primary residence from the mid-1820s, even though Zachary's military duties kept him away a lot. But their financial interests extended beyond that. In April 1842, Taylor made a significant purchase, the Cypress Grove Plantation in Jefferson County, Mississippi. This was a huge property, 1,823 acres, and it came with 81 enslaved people. Cost him $95,000, which, get this, is equivalent to about $3.1 million today.
A massive investment.
Huge. And by the time of his death in 1850, the number of enslaved individuals on that property had grown to 127, maybe even more. Some reports claimed at least 200. What's interesting, though, is that despite being in one of Mississippi's most productive cotton-growing regions, Cypress Grove actually struggled. Low cotton prices, flooding, pests. It plagued the operation. Taylor was an absentee owner, mostly. But he did try to make it self-sufficient, even appointed his son Richard as co-manager.
This complex relationship with slavery and land ownership, especially with the economic challenges, really underscores the personal stake he had in the Southern economic system.
Right.
Yet, as you mentioned, his future actions regarding the institution would be far from what many expected. It's a fascinating tension.
Now, let's fast forward to his military career, where he truly became a legend. Taylor joined the U.S. Army in 1808 as a first lieutenant. It was a direct response to the Chesapeake-Leopard Affair, which had sparked calls for war with Britain. He caught a nasty disease in the camps of New Orleans, but recovered and got promoted to captain in 1810. Then came the War of 1812, where he really made his mark. He famously defended Fort Harrison in Indiana Territory from a fierce attack by Tecumseh's forces. That earned him a brevet promotion to major, the very first in U.S. history, according to one historian.
That's quite a distinction early on.
It is. After some other engagements and a brief resignation, he re-entered the Army as a major, setting the stage for decades of frontier service. That old rough-and-ready nickname starts here, doesn't it? What's that tell us about his leadership style even then?
His reputation as old, rough-and-ready wasn't just a nickname. It reflected a no-nonsense, resilient leader. He earned respect on the battlefield through sheer grit and a willingness to share the hardships of his men. He was known for being unpretentious, often appearing in simple dress, sort of blurring the lines between officer and enlisted man.
Very different from the typical image of a general.
Exactly. A stark contrast to the political arena he would later enter, where image and rhetoric often trumped directness. He commanded various forts along the Mississippi River, including Fort Howard, and was promoted to lieutenant colonel in 1819. He even dined with President James Monroe and General Andrew Jackson, showing his rising prominence, proving he was moving in powerful circles. Then he helped establish Fort Selden and Fort Jessup, pushing the American frontier further west, constantly expanding the reach of the young nation.
And his experience with Native American conflicts continued, shaping that rough-and-ready persona. In 1832, he was promoted to colonel and campaigned against Chief Black Hawk's forces during the Black Hawk War. But beyond the battlefield, there's a poignant personal story from this period that ties into the future of the nation in a profoundly personal way. Taylor actually opposed his own daughter, Sarah Knox Taylor's courtship with a young lieutenant named Jefferson Davis.
Right, the same Jefferson Davis.
He respected Davis, apparently, but he knew firsthand the immense hardships of military life for families, and he didn't want that for his daughter. Despite his objections, she married Davis at 21, only to tragically die of malaria just 3 months later.
A devastating blow.
That's a powerful glimpse into the personal cost of a military life, and it's haunting to think how that connection with Jefferson Davis would echo in American history.
It's a truly heartbreaking personal tragedy, and one that adds layers to Taylor's character. He understood sacrifice. Then came the Second Seminole War in Florida in 1837. Taylor was directed to build forts and supply depots, culminating in the Battle of Lake Okeechobee on Christmas Day. It was a brutal, large-scale engagement against the Seminole and Miccosukee tribes, one of the largest U.S. Indian battles of the 19th century. His success there earned him a promotion to Brigadier General and really cemented his nickname, Old Rough and Ready, nationwide.
But there was controversy too, right?
There was. This period wasn't without controversy. He was criticized for using bloodhounds to track Seminoles, a tactic that raised ethical questions even then. After a comfortable year touring the nation and commanding the Western Division, in April 1844, Taylor was sent to Fort Jessup in Louisiana. This was in anticipation of the annexation of Texas and guarding against Mexican claims. President Polk chose Taylor specifically because of his widely perceived apolitical reputation over other senior Whig generals like Winfield Scott.
Interesting choice by Polk.
It was. This choice reveals just how much Taylor's national renown already transcended traditional party lines, making him an attractive figurehead even before he sought office. And this is where Taylor transitions from a regional military leader to a bona fide national phenomenon. With the annexation of Texas in 1845, tensions with Mexico just soared. President Polk dispatched Taylor to the Rio Grande, positioning him on or near the Rio Grande to guard against Mexican claims. This was a deliberate act of provocation.
Setting the stage.
Definitely. When Polk's diplomatic negotiations failed, Taylor's advance to the river in March 1846 quickly led to the Thornton Affair, where Mexican forces attacked his men. That effectively kicked off the Mexican-American War in April 1846. It was a calculated move by Polk, but Taylor was the one on the ground leading the charge.
And this is where his legend truly exploded, turning him into a household name. In May 1846, Taylor commanded American forces at the Battle of Palo Alto and the Battle of Resaca de la Palma. Despite being greatly outnumbered, he decisively defeated General Mariano Arista's Army of the North, driving Mexican troops out of Texas. And here's a remarkable detail that speaks volumes about his character, maybe his later political approach too. Taylor was praised for his humane treatment of wounded Mexican soldiers, giving them the same care as Americans, performing last rites for the dead of both sides.
That stands out, doesn't it?
It really does. This wasn't just good PR. It was a reflection of his inherent pragmatism and respect, even for an enemy.
Following these initial victories, Taylor led his troops further into Mexico, capturing the strategic city of Monterrey in just 3 days in September 1846. He inflicted heavy casualties on the Mexican forces. Though, interestingly, he was criticized by President Polk's administration back in Washington.
Criticized. For winning.
For offering a liberal truce rather than pushing for a large-scale surrender that could have further humiliated Mexico. The political tensions back home were already brewing, and Polk, hoping to acquire Alta California and New Mexico, shifted many of Taylor's experienced soldiers and much of his artillery to General Winfield Scott's command. That left Taylor with a smaller, less effective force. Mexican General Antonio Lopez de Santillana, intercepting a letter from Scott about Taylor's reduced strength, saw an opportunity for a decisive victory.
So Santa Anna sees weakness. With a force of 20,000 men, he moved north, intent on destroying Taylor. But Old Rough and Ready lived up to his name. He refused to retreat. He established a strong defensive position near Saltillo, which led to the legendary Battle of Buena Vista in February 1847. Again, Taylor was severely outnumbered, a staggering disadvantage. Yet he inflicted a crushing blow on Santa Anna's forces. American casualties were around 700, while Mexican casualties were over 1,500. It was a huge victory that solidified his status as a national hero and arguably put him on the path to the presidency. How did this particular victory, against such odds, impact the American psyche?
Oh, the impact was immense, host. Buena Vista was a David and Goliath story that resonated deeply across the country. The recognition was immediate and widespread. He received a brevet promotion to Major General and a formal commendation from Congress in May 1846, followed by a full promotion in June. The National Press lauded him, comparing him to revered figures like George Washington and Andrew Jackson, both generals who had become president, you know. That comparison wasn't accidental.
Setting the stage for his political future.
Precisely. He, in fact, received 3 congressional gold medals for his service in the Mexican-American War. He's the only person to ever receive it 3 times.
3 times? That's incredible.
It is. And Ulysses S. Grant, who served under Taylor during the war, he really lauded his leadership. Grant stated, "A better army, man for man, probably never faced an enemy than the one commanded by General Taylor." Grant also noted Taylor's remarkable ability to do the best he could with the means given to him without parading his grievance before the public. These qualities, Grant believed, were more rarely found than genius. It was this blend of decisive action, personal resilience, and apparent lack of political ambition that made him so appealing to a nation weary of partisan squabbling.
Right. This is where Taylor's story takes that dramatic turn from military leader to a national phenomenon. His victories and personal qualities, that old rough-and-ready resilience, commitment to his troops, perceived integrity, they resonated so deeply with the American public. It created this groundswell that would soon propel him to a completely different kind of battleground, politics. It's hard to overstate how much his military triumphs transformed him into a national figure, even against his own initial inclinations. He was seen as a man of action, uncorrupted by Washington. And that takes us directly to part 2, the reluctant politician and unexpected path to the White House. So we've seen Taylor forged in the fires of frontier warfare, rising to national hero status. But now we pivot to what might be the most bizarre chapter of his life, his unexpected and frankly deeply reluctant ascent into the cutthroat world of presidential politics. Given what we know about him as a military man, how truly astounding is it that he had never even voted before his own election? What does that tell us about the kind of presidential candidate the nation was looking for at that incredibly fractured moment?
It's profoundly astounding, host. And it tells us volumes about the political climate of the late 1840s. Taylor was fundamentally not a politician. As a career military officer, he had never publicly revealed his political beliefs before 1848 and, yeah, never even voted prior to his own election.
Just wild.
It is. He was famously apolitical,
yeah,
and held a rather negative opinion of most politicians, seeing himself as an independent, a man above the fray. The fact that the nation turned to such a figure signals deep disillusionment with professional politicians, I think. A longing for an outsider, a man of the people, even if that man was paradoxically a Southern planter and slaveholder. And this is crucial to understanding. Taylor, while he was a slave owner from the South, his pragmatic and nationalist views often put him at odds with the pro-slavery expansionist agenda, even within his own party. He held a few core beliefs, though. He believed in a strong banking system for the country, for example. He thought President Andrew Jackson had been wrong to let the Second Bank of the United States collapse a classic Whig-leaning position. But more significantly, he was a firm American nationalist. Having witnessed so much death and destruction through warfare, he believed that secession was just a terrible way to resolve national problems. He saw it as potentially catastrophic. Regarding slavery, he held a rather pragmatic view. He believed it was economically infeasible in the Western U.S. Cotton or sugar, the main crops reliant on slave labor, just couldn't be easily grown there, in his view. Because of this, he opposed its expansion in the new territories, viewing it as a needless source of controversy that threatened the very union he held dear. That stance coming from a Southern slaveholder must have been explosive.
Oh, absolutely. It would prove highly controversial and deeply shape his political trajectory, alienating both sides at different times. So, despite his reluctance, the political buzz around Taylor grew immensely. Even before his victory at Buena Vista, political clubs supporting him for president had started forming. His support was remarkably broad, cutting across Whigs and Democrats, North and South. Initially, he denied any interest, famously remarking in a letter, "Such an idea never entered my head, nor is it likely to enter the head of any sane person."
A classic Taylor.
Right. But by late 1846, his opposition began to weaken, and his principles started to align more closely with Whig orthodoxy, especially his disdain for President Polk and his policies, which he viewed as too aggressive and expansionist. What was it about him that attracted the Whigs, specifically? Why him?
Well, the Whigs were actively looking for another war hero, much like William Henry Harrison, who had won for them in 1840.
Ah, the Tippecanoe model. It's exactly. A general who could potentially unite disparate factions and avoid divisive political debates. Taylor began to make some key declarations that nudged him into their camp. He stated he would have voted for the Whig Henry Clay in 1844 if he'd voted at all, which was a clear signal. And in a widely publicized letter in September 1847, he clarified some positions. Didn't favor a national bank, supported a low tariff, primarily for revenue, not protectionism. And he believed the president should play no role in lawmaking, only vetoing unconstitutional laws, a classic Whig stance, advocating for a weaker executive and stronger Congress. Now, his stance on the Wilmot Proviso, that proposal to ban slavery in new territories, was particularly telling and alienated various factions. He angered Southerners by suggesting he would not veto the proviso if it came to his desk. That implied a willingness to accept a ban on slavery's expansion.
A big deal for a Southerner?
Huge. Yet this didn't satisfy abolitionists, who wanted a strong statement for it, not just passive acceptance. Most abolitionists still didn't support him ultimately because he was a slave owner. Despite initially refusing to identify with any party in February 1848, he really wanted to be seen as a national candidate. He was eventually convinced by influential Whigs like Senator John J. Crittenden of Kentucky to declare himself a Whig. It was a pragmatic move to secure the nomination.
And it paid off. At the 1848 Whig National Convention, Taylor, the military man with these, well, vague political leanings, defeated seasoned politicians like Winfield Scott and the venerable Henry Clay for the nomination. To balance the ticket and appease Northern Whigs, who were less than thrilled about a Southern slave owner as their nominee, Millard Fillmore, a prominent New York Whig, was chosen as his vice president. But it was clear from the start that, as one historian put it, no faction of the party was satisfied with the final ticket, highlighting the deep divisions Taylor was already navigating even before taking office. You know, for a man so disinterested in politics, his nomination came with a truly bizarre, almost unbelievable anecdote that perfectly captures his old rough-and-ready persona. Our sources reveal that when the letters announcing his presidential nomination arrived, he didn't even respond. Why was that? And what does that seemingly trivial act tell us about how profoundly different campaigns were back then, and maybe about Taylor himself?
It's an incredible story, and it speaks volumes. Taylor, notoriously frugal, had instructed his local post office not to deliver his mail if it had postage due, to avoid paying the fees.
No way, including the nomination letter.
Including the nomination letter. Presidential nomination letters were no exception. This wasn't just a quirky anecdote. It reinforced his image as a common man, uninterested in the trappings of political ambition. He largely minimized his role in the campaign, did little active campaigning himself, and in a final twist of irony for a presidential candidate, he may not have even voted in the election himself.
That's amazing.
This detachment from the political process, while endearing to some, also meant he was coming into the presidency with very little practical experience in political negotiation and compromise, which would definitely prove challenging. The Democrats, too, were deeply divided in 1848, which further cleared Taylor's path. Former Democratic President Martin Van Buren broke from the party to lead the anti-slavery Free Soil Party ticket.
The Free Soilers, right.
Yeah. And they drew crucial votes from the Democratic nominee, Lewis Cass, especially in key states like New York. Van Buren's spoiler candidacy effectively siphoned off enough votes from Cass to hand those states, and ultimately the election, to Taylor. This disunity among the Democrats ultimately worked in Taylor's favor, demonstrating how external factors often play as big a role as internal strengths in presidential elections.
And so, Zachary Taylor, the unlikely candidate, won. He defeated Cass and Van Buren, securing 163 of the 290 electoral votes and 47.3% of the popular vote. What's striking is how he approached the Whig Party platform. As historian Michael F. Holt explains, Taylor was indifferent to programs Whigs had long considered vital. Privately, he was even more direct, dismissing the idea of a national bank as dead, favoring tariffs only for revenue, and stating that internal improvements would happen in spite of presidential vetoes. So he's elected as a Whig, but essentially plans to govern as an independent. That sounds incredibly risky for a first-time politician, especially given the deep partisan divisions of the 1840s. Was this independent streak seen as refreshing candor or just political naivete by the establishment?
That's a crucial question, and the answer is probably both, depending on who you asked. This signals a president who, despite running under a party banner, was really prepared to govern on his own terms, largely disconnected from traditional party platforms. For many Americans, particularly those tired of political maneuvering, his candor and military directness were refreshing. They wanted someone who would just get things done.
The appeal of the outsider.
Exactly. However, for the political establishment, especially the Whig leaders like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, it was seen as political naivete, maybe even an insult. They expected a president to uphold the party's principles. This independence streak, born from his military background and personal convictions, would profoundly define his short presidency, for better or worse. He confronted the most explosive issues of his era with a distinctly non-political approach, often alienating the very people he needed for support.
Which brings us to part three, the brief presidency sectional crisis and sudden end. Taylor maintained his distance from Washington even after the election, only resigning his military command in late January 1849. He was incredibly deliberate and quiet about his cabinet selections, much to the frustration of many Whigs who felt entitled to positions. His philosophy seemed to be avoiding prominent Whigs and Democrats, aiming instead for geographical diversity and presumably loyalty to him personally rather than a party faction. John M. Clayton of Delaware became Secretary of State, and Thomas Ewing became the very first Secretary of the Interior, a brand new department. That's a significant development in itself.
It really is, creating that department.
But his own vice president, Millard Fillmore, was largely sidelined from the start, contributing to a sense of internal division within his own administration.
This early stage of his presidency reveals a man trying to navigate an entirely new world for him. He was relying on a diverse but not necessarily strong or politically connected cabinet, and already facing skepticism from seasoned politicians. Outgoing President James K. Polk, for instance, privately held a very low opinion of Taylor. He deemed him without political information and wholly unqualified for the station of president.
Ouch.
Yeah, harsh words. And that sentiment was likely shared by many D.C. insiders. Taylor's inauguration was even delayed by a day to March 5, 1849, because March 4 fell on a Sunday. A nod to religious concerns, maybe, but also a minor hiccup reflecting the general unpreparedness. His speech emphasized deference to Congress and sectional compromise, while also upholding Washington's precedent of avoiding entangling alliances. Interestingly, it was Taylor who coined the phrase First Lady in his eulogy for Dolly Madison.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yep, a term that became a permanent part of our political lexicon.
Now, let's talk about the sectional crisis he walked straight into. As Taylor took office, Congress faced a battery of critical questions related to the Mexican Cession, those vast new territories acquired after the Mexican-American War. The central issue, of course, was whether these areas would become states or territories, and crucially, their status regarding slavery. Southerners threatened secession if California, New Mexico, and Utah were to enter the Union as free states. What were the specific flashpoints that elevated this crisis to such a dangerous level? How did they directly challenge the fragile unity of the nation?
The stakes were incredibly high, Host, and it was a confluence of several explosive issues heating up simultaneously. Firstly, Northerners were increasingly aiding fugitive slaves and refusing to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. This infuriated the South, who saw it as a violation of their property rights and federal law.
A direct challenge.
Absolutely. Secondly, there were growing demands from Northerners to abolish the domestic slave trade in Washington, D.C. Southerners viewed this as an attack on slavery itself, even symbolically, right there in the nation's capital. And adding to this powder keg, Texas claimed a large swath of eastern New Mexico and threatened military action to enforce its territorial claims. That would have meant more land potentially open to slavery. It was a powder keg. And Taylor, a southern slave owner himself, had a surprising approach that defied expectations. Despite his background, Taylor was a staunch nationalist above all else, it seems. He believed that slavery was economically infeasible in the arid Mexican Cession, where cotton and sugar couldn't be easily grown. Therefore, he opposed its expansion there, seeing it as a needless source of controversy that threatened the very union he held sacred.
So pragmatism again.
Mostly, yes.
Yep.
His primary goal was sectional peace and preserving the union through swift legislative action. In a move that truly surprised and angered many Southerners, he sided increasingly with anti-slavery Northerners, like Senator William H. Seward of New York. He even suggested he would sign the Wilmot Proviso, aiming to ban slavery in federal territories if it reached his desk.
That must have sent shockwaves through the South.
It did.
Yeah.
This was not the position many expected from him, particularly from a man who personally owned over 100 slaves. It's a testament to his military pragmatism, trumping traditional sectional loyalty, perhaps.
And Taylor had a very direct, almost military-style plan for this. His strategy was to bypass the territorial stage entirely for California and New Mexico, pushing them directly to statehood. For California, the timing was perfect due to the ongoing gold rush, which was rapidly increasing the population. He dispatched Representative Thomas Butler King to California to advocate for statehood, knowing full well that Californians, with their diverse population, would adopt an anti-slavery constitution. And by October 1849, a constitutional convention was indeed underway, and they unanimously agreed to ban slavery and join the Union.
This seems like a clever maneuver, almost circumventing Congress, doesn't it?
It was bold, certainly, trying to force the issue. For the New Mexico-Texas border dispute, Texas claimed a swath of land north of Santa Fe, intensifying the conflict. Taylor sided firmly with New Mexico's claim. He initially pushed for federal territory status and then quickly pivoted to statehood to further reduce the congressional debate over slavery. When Texas Governor Bell ramped up military action, threatening to seize the land, Taylor remained firm and Bell's efforts were ultimately unsuccessful. As for the Utah Territory, the Latter-day Saints had established a provisional state of Deseret, but it had little hope of congressional recognition. Taylor, ever the pragmatist, organized it as the Utah Territory, promising the Mormons relative independence from Congress to preserve their religious freedom, effectively pushing another hot potato towards resolution.
In December 1849, Taylor delivered his only State of the Union report to Congress. While he touched on international events and tariff policy, the sectional crisis overshadowed everything. He recommended that Congress approve California's and New Mexico's statehood as written, effectively presenting them as a fait accompli. And he urged them to abstain from the introduction of those exciting topics of a sectional character. He concluded with a sharp condemnation of secessionists, making it clear he viewed threats to the Union with military seriousness.
Strong words. Did they work?
Not really. His strong words had little effect. Southern legislators viewed the admission of two free states as an existential threat, a dramatic imbalance of power. Congress remained stalled, completely paralyzed. This is a pivotal moment. Taylor, the general, trying to impose a military-style solution on a deeply political problem, attempting to force the issue through statehood rather than congressional debate. It showed his decisive leadership, sure, but also maybe his political inexperience in navigating complex legislative compromises. He underestimated the entrenched interests and the power of political rhetoric.
Despite his intense focus on the domestic crisis, Taylor still had to navigate global politics. And this section is quite interesting. Both Taylor and his Secretary of State, John M. Clayton, came into office with limited diplomatic experience, which could have been a recipe for disaster. However, their shared nationalism allowed Taylor to largely devolve foreign policy matters to Clayton, though no truly decisive or broad foreign policy doctrine was established. They vocally supported German and Hungarian liberals during the 1848 revolutions, aligning with their anti-autocratic European order stance. Why was it only vocal support and no actual aid? What did that signal on the world stage?
That's a great question, host. The vocal support was largely symbolic, I think. It aligned with American ideals of self-determination and republicanism, which definitely resonated with a segment of the public back home. However, the prevailing sentiment in American foreign policy since Washington's farewell address was to avoid entangling alliances.
Right, the old warning.
Exactly. Providing material aid to European revolutionaries would have been a radical departure from this long-standing tradition. It risked direct conflict with established European powers. So it was a way of expressing solidarity without committing to the immense costs and geopolitical entanglements of intervention. There were some minor tensions during his administration, too. A perceived insult from the French minister, Guillaume Tell Poussin, nearly led to a diplomatic break until Poussin was eventually replaced after some harsh words from the Taylor administration. And a reparation dispute with Portugal resulted in some very sharp diplomatic exchanges, again showcasing that sort of blunt, no-nonsense approach.
Not exactly subtle diplomacy.
No. On a more positive note, the administration arranged for two ships to assist the United Kingdom in their search for British explorers led by John Franklin, who were lost in the Arctic, a small but significant act of international cooperation. He also contended with what was known as Cuban filibustering, not the political obstruction we think of today, but private military expeditions.
Ah, right. You mentioned this earlier.
Yeah, like those led by Narciso Lopez, aiming to conquer Cuba. These weren't sanctioned by the U.S. government, but they represented a clear challenge to American neutrality and a deeply controversial bid to expand slave states. Taylor and Clayton labeled them illegal, blockaded the efforts, and arrested Lopez, though he was later acquitted.
That's a crucial clarification on filibustering. Thank you.
Huh?
But perhaps the most defining foreign policy accomplishment of the Taylor administration was the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty of 1850 with Britain. This agreement concerned a proposed interoceanic canal through Central America, potentially linking the Atlantic and Pacific. While the actual construction of such a canal was decades away, the possibility raised uneasy questions between the two nations, especially as Britain had been aggressively seizing strategic points, like the Mosquito Coast. What was the long-term significance of this treaty beyond its immediate provisions? What did it mean for U.S. foreign policy and Anglo-American relations moving forward?
The Clayton-Bulwer Treaty wasn't just some dry diplomatic agreement. It was actually a pretty visionary piece of diplomacy. It recognized the strategic importance of an interoceanic canal decades before its construction. At a time when both the U.S. and Britain were jockeying for influence in Central America, this treaty laid down a precedent of mutual non-exclusivity.
Meaning?
It essentially said, neither of us will control this vital trade artery alone. This commitment to a shared future, rather than unilateral control, marked a significant departure from pure manifest destiny, which often implied U.S. dominance. It really set the stage for later international cooperation on the Panama Canal. It promoted an Anglo-American alliance, diffusing a potential flashpoint.
That's pretty impressive for such a short presidency.
It is. It's truly impressive that a president so consumed by domestic crisis could still leave such a forward-thinking international legacy, shaping global trade routes for generations. Its completion was actually Taylor's very last action as president, a quiet but profound achievement.
As the sectional crisis deepened, and with Taylor's statehood plan stalled, Henry Clay stepped back into the spotlight. He developed his landmark proposal known as the Compromise of 1850. It was an omnibus bill, a package deal that included California statehood as a free state, other territories remaining under federal jurisdiction, including disputed New Mexico, with Texas reimbursed for its claims. Also, slavery retained in Washington, D.C., but the slave trade banned there, and importantly, a strict fugitive slave law enacted. However, Taylor maintained his distance from Clay and actively opposed this omnibus bill. He still believed in his own statehood plan and was wary of radicals on both sides. This sounds like a recipe for disaster in Congress.
It absolutely was.
All right.
This led directly to Taylor's growing political isolation. Southerners disapproved of his preference for free states in the Mexican Cession, seeing it as a betrayal from one of their own.
Understandable from their perspective.
Right. At the same time, Northerners disapproved of his opposition to Clay's compromise agenda, which many saw as the only viable path to avoid disunion. As a result, Congress increasingly ignored him. Tensions escalated dramatically. Taylor threatened to lead troops into New Mexico himself to protect its border from Texas. He stated he would hang rebels with less reluctance than he had hanged deserters and spies in Mexico.
Wow, strong language, military language.
Very. His close advisors, including Southern Whigs Robert Toombs and Alexander Stevens, were appalled. They warned him that such fiery rhetoric would drive Southerners out of the Whig Party entirely. He was a general, prepared to use force in a political situation that really demanded negotiation and compromise.
And as if the sectional crisis wasn't enough, Taylor's final days were completely overshadowed by a major scandal known as the Galphin Affair. Before joining the cabinet, Secretary of War George W. Crawford had been a lawyer involved in a 15-year legal case. He represented the descendants of a colonial trader, George Galphin. Galphin was owed a debt by the British Crown, which the federal government had assumed. After years of litigation, Galphin's heirs had only received the principal, not the interest, from the previous Polk administration. Beyond just undermining his authority, how badly did this particular scandal erode public trust? What did it signal about Taylor's grasp on the reins of power during such a volatile period?
It was devastating, host, for multiple reasons. The scandalous part came in April 1850, when Treasury Secretary Meredith, with the support of Attorney General Johnson, finally approved the interest payment. But this payment included a huge legal compensation fee, nearly $100,000, going directly to Crawford himself.
To the Secretary of War.
Exactly. Imagine that. Two cabinet members effectively signing off on a massive payment from the public treasury to another cabinet member, a huge conflict of interest. A House investigation ultimately cleared Crawford of actual legal wrongdoing, but expressed strong disapproval of him accepting the payment while in office. Taylor, who was already sketching a cabinet reorganization in frustration, now faced an unfolding scandal that completely undermined his authority. The House of Representatives even voted to censure Taylor, and newspapers from both parties began calling for his impeachment.
Impeachment calls. Yeah. Already.
Yes. The Galphin Affair, coming at a time of intense sectional division, just completely crippled Taylor's political standing. It made him seem either complicit or utterly out of touch. It's a stark reminder of how quickly political fortunes can turn, even for a national hero.
And here's where Zachary Taylor's story takes its most dramatic and mysterious turn, his sudden death. On July 4, 1850, Taylor reportedly consumed copious amounts of cherries and iced milk while attending holiday celebrations at the Washington Monument, which was then under construction. A seemingly innocent summer treat, right? But one that would soon lead to a tragic outcome.
Over the next several days, he became severely ill with an unknown digestive ailment. While initially seeming mild, his condition rapidly worsened. It resembled acute gastroenteritis. His army physician diagnosed the illness as cholera morbus, Now, that was a chum in the mid-19th century that covered various intestinal ailments like diarrhea and dysentery. It wasn't necessarily related to the more severe Asiatic cholera, though Asiatic cholera was prevalent in Washington, D.C. at the time due to unsanitary conditions, open sewers, that sort of thing.
Okay, so cholera morbus was a bit vague.
It was. What's concerning, though, is how his doctors treated him. They used what we now know were incredibly aggressive and likely harmful methods. We're talking Ipecac, calomel, opium, and quinine at a staggering 40 grains per dose. That's about 2.6 grams. Mm. And they also bled and blistered him.
Bleeding and blistering still.
Oh, yes. These were common but brutal treatments of the era, and they almost certainly worsened his condition significantly.
His condition became dire, and on July 8th, Taylor remarked to a medical attendant, chillingly, "I should not be surprised if this were to terminate in my death." He continued, "I did not expect to encounter what has beset me since my elevation to the presidency. God knows I have endeavored to fulfill what I conceive to be an honest duty, but I have been mistaken. My motives have been misconstrued, and my feelings most grossly outraged."
Wow. Powerful last words.
Aren't they? He died at 10:35 p.m. on July 9, 1850, at the age of 65, just 16 months into his term. Vice President Millard Fillmore immediately assumed the presidency and soon after signed the Compromise of 1850. This is a dramatic and tragic end to a short presidency, made even more intriguing by the circumstances. His last words reveal a man who felt deeply misunderstood, maybe overwhelmed by the political battles. How quickly did the rumors of foul play begin, and what did that reveal about the intense political suspicion of that era?
Almost immediately after his death, rumors began to circulate that Taylor had been poisoned. Some suspected pro-slavery Southerners who felt betrayed by his stance on expansion. Others even blamed Catholics, which speaks to the deep-seated nativist prejudices of the time.
Poison theories right away.
Right away. And these theories persisted for a very long time, even into the 21st century. President Fillmore himself received a letter alleging a Jesuit lay official had poisoned Taylor, showing how pervasive and seriously these claims were taken, at least by some. Later theories, like Hamilton Smith's in 1978, pointed to the timing of various drugs and the lack of confirmed Asiatic cholera outbreaks, fueling speculation. And in 1881, a New York Times editorial by John Bingham, famous for his role in the Lincoln assassination trial, even alleged that Jefferson Davis had poisoned Taylor.
Davis again. That's a shocking accusation, given their personal history.
Extremely shocking. The very persistence of these rumors speaks volumes about the intense political climate and the deep-seated distrust that permeated the country on the eve of the Civil War.
With all these persistent rumors swirling for over a century, a former professor named Clara Rising in the late 1980s persuaded Taylor's closest living relative to agree to an exhumation. So in June 1991, nearly 141 years after his death, Taylor's remains were exhumed and transported to the office of the Kentucky Chief Medical Examiner. Samples of hair, fingernail, and other tissues were removed, and extensive radiological studies were conducted. This was a truly unprecedented step to resolve a historical mystery.
And the scientific findings from neutron activation analysis conducted at Oak Ridge National Laboratory were definitive. They revealed absolutely no evidence of poisoning. The arsenic levels found were several hundred times lower than necessary to cause death, completely debunking the assassination theories.
So science settled it.
Pretty much. The overwhelming conclusion from this analysis was that Taylor had contracted cholera morbus, or acute gastroenteritis. Most likely from contaminated food or drink, a plausible scenario given Washington, D.C.'s primitive open sewers at the time. Furthermore, the aggressive treatments administered by his doctors, Ipecac, calomel, opium, quinine, bleeding, and blistering, were almost certainly detrimental. They likely worsened his condition, if not outright contributed to his demise.
So the cure might have been worse than the disease.
Quite possibly. While science has largely debunked the assassination theories, the fact that they persisted for so long and that his doctor's cures were so harsh really makes you wonder about the state of medical knowledge and political suspicion in that era. Was it a natural death, exacerbated by poor medicine? Or was there more to the historical speculation that fueled such long-lasting theories, rooted in the very real tensions of a divided nation? Something to think about.
Now, let's turn to part four, legacy and remembrance. Given his incredibly short tenure, just 16 months, Zachary Taylor is generally not considered to have strongly influenced the office of the presidency or the nation in a lasting way. He's often ranked in the bottom quartile of U.S. presidents, with historians describing him as more a forgettable president than a failed one, largely due to his political inexperience at a time that demanded deep ties with political operatives. Why is he considered so forgettable, especially given his military hero status and his direct, if controversial, stance on slavery's expansion?
That's a perceptive question. Taylor's brevity in office certainly affects his historical standing. He simply didn't have enough time to enact significant policies or build a lasting political machine, you know. He entered the presidency as an outsider and died before he could truly learn the ropes of political leadership. However, the issues he grappled with, especially the escalating slavery crisis, were absolutely monumental. One key accomplishment often cited, however, is that Clayton-Bulwer Treaty of 1850.
Right, the Canal Treaty.
Yes. That treaty, regarding the potential interoceanic canal through Central America, is recognized as an important step in scaling down the nation's commitment to manifest destiny as a policy. That's a significant diplomatic achievement that looks far into the future. He also holds a few notable firsts and lasts. He was the last president to own slaves while in office, the third of four Whig presidents, and the second president to die in office, after William Henry Harrison. So while his direct impact on policy was limited, his actions and his death came at an absolutely critical juncture for the nation.
Despite his short time in office and his forgettable ranking among presidents, Taylor did leave his mark on the nation's landscape and cultural memory. In 1883, the Commonwealth of Kentucky placed a magnificent 50-foot monument topped by a life-size statue near his grave, honoring his military achievements. Then, in the 1920s, his family initiated efforts to transform the burial grounds into a national cemetery, recognizing his service to the nation. The Commonwealth of Kentucky donated adjacent land, expanding his half-acre family plot into 16 acres.
Indeed. On May 5, 1926, the remains of Taylor and his wife Margaret were moved to a newly constructed limestone mausoleum, a more fitting final resting place. This property was officially designated as the Zachary Taylor National Cemetery in 1928, solidifying his place in national remembrance. He's also been honored on U.S. postage stamps multiple times in 1875, 1938, and 1986. He was actually the fifth American president to appear on U.S. postage after Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, and Lincoln.
That's pretty good company.
It is. A testament to his enduring, if often unexamined, place in the public consciousness. His name also lives on in numerous places. Camp Taylor in Kentucky, Fort Zachary Taylor in Florida, the Zachary Taylor Parkway in Louisiana, several Taylor counties across different states, and the Zachary Taylor Highway in Virginia. There's even a sea shanty called General Taylor that recounts his victory at the Battle of Buena Vista.
A sea shanty. That's something.
It is. His story reminds us that even presidents who served briefly can offer profound insights into the challenges and complexities of American history, and that popular memory often remembers military heroism even when political leadership fades.
So we've taken a deep dive into the life of Zachary Taylor, the unlikely president, the military hero forged on the American frontier, the Southern slaveholder who surprisingly opposed the expansion of slavery, and the man whose sudden death sparked centuries of speculation. His time in office was short, a mere 16 months, but the issues he faced were foundational to the nation's future, leading directly into the greatest crisis of American history.
His story truly highlights the dramatic tension between personal conviction, political expediency, and, well, the inexorable forces of history. Taylor tried to forge a path of national unity, advocating for swift statehood to bypass divisive debates, only to find himself increasingly isolated. He was grappling with issues that would ultimately tear the country apart, even as he stood against the tide of secession. He was a general trying to command a nation, and the political battlefield proved far more complex than any military one he'd faced.
Taylor died believing his motives had been misconstrued and his feelings grossly outraged. Considering the intense political climate of 1850 and the looming shadow of the Civil War, here's a thought for you to ponder. Do you think a longer Taylor presidency, with his unique blend of military pragmatism and Southern slaveholding background, could have actually steered the nation away from the precipice? Or was the sectional crisis just an unstoppable force by that point, regardless of who occupied the White House? It's a question that makes you ponder the very nature of leadership and destiny in times of profound national division. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and keep learning.